By now, you've probably heard about Linux, but whether you're a pro or have barely heard the word, Scale. The Southern California Linux Expo has something for you. Scale 6X will have over 50 speakers covering the hottest topics in open source software and more than 75 booths this year representing a wide range of commercial products and nonprofit organizations. Don't forget Friday's special sessions with Docs, open source software in the healthcare industry, the Women in Open Source Conference, and new this year is the Open Source Software in Education Conference. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2008 at the Westin LAX Hotel in Los Angeles, California. For more information and to register for the expo, visit socallinuxexpo.org. Use promo code CAST, that's C-A-S-T, for 40% off of your registration. We'll see you at Scale.
The Linux Link Tech Show.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's get down to business.
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to the new Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open technology, and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show, episode 229. This is January 23, 2008. Welcome, everybody. We've got a full house tonight. Alan
is back.
Well, cousins, I'm on. Link is making it 3 weeks in a row. Welcome back, Link, for another episode.
Woo-hoo. Yeah.
And, of course, Dan is in the house with American Idol.
No, they're watching Discovery Channel.
Oh, a little educational tonight.
Yeah, we're trying to, I don't know what we're doing.
And with this, we have a fantastic guest. We've got Clement Lefebvre from Linux Mint.
Hi, guys.
Welcome to the show. It's a great honor. Well,
thanks for having me. Thank you.
Welcome.
And you're gonna tell us exactly what Linux Mint is, because I know people have a lot of misconceptions and consider it just Ubuntu with Codex, but you say it's a lot more than that. I think you're lying, but you can tell us the truth.
it started as Ubuntu plus Codex, and it's basically, if you look at it from a technical point of view, it basically is Ubuntu. But the project itself is very different, and the purpose of Linux Mint is not to add Codex to Ubuntu or to do anything to Ubuntu. It's just to produce an operating system for desktop users. So to do that, we use Ubuntu because it's the easiest way to achieve the purpose. But Ubuntu is simply it's like one component in the equation, and it can be changed the same way we go for GNOME, and we can change GNOME and use KDE. We can use Ubuntu and today and move to Debian tomorrow, or actually implement a Mint desktop on top of Fedora, or even roll out our own base. So it is Ubuntu technically, but the point is the resulting desktop, and it's not about what base we use or which codex we actually put in the operating system. It's about the user experience and how we make the experience better for the user, basically.
You must be doing something right, Clement, because I'm looking at DistroWatch, the rankings for the last 30 days, and Linux Mint is third right now. Ahead of OpenSUSE, Fedora, Debian, Mepis, Mandriva. You must be doing something right.
Or something wrong, according to what you were saying earlier.
Dan, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well,
Yeah, I suppose Windows is first on the market, so, you know, popularity is not always a good sign.
No, but I mean, I mean, what you were talking about, what Linux Mint is, and what my understanding of, initially what I thought Linux Mint was, a specific distribution, you are moving away from that. So, and I find what you're moving towards very interesting.
Yeah, well, we experimented, different bases and we released an alpha edition, an alpha ISO on based on Debian. And the reason we did that was because we wanted to see how what we developed would behave on a different base. Because basically from the start we I used Ubuntu and it worked very well. But I just wanted to see if the features we developed on top of Ubuntu would work on different base. So the targets were at Debian to start with, and maybe in a few months' time we'll probably do the same with Fedora to see if things work well with RPM as well. But it's just experimenting different things. The purpose is to basically make a good desktop and the best base for us to use at the moment is Ubuntu.
So what is the definition of a good desktop according to the Linux Mint project? What separates Linux Mint from, you know, what you get stock from Ubuntu or Mepis or Fedora or anything else? I mean, what is it about Linux Mint that sets it apart?
Well, it's driven by two different things. The first thing is for people who know their way around, not to have to do repetitive things like every time you install an operating system, you usually go for codecs, for instance. So if you're going to install them, they may as well be installed by default. If people prefer Thunderbird, then we're going to go for Thunderbird. It's to make it easy for users, even advanced users. And the second thing is for people who are new to computers, to simplify use cases. So, for instance, one of the use cases that we identified in the latest release was the fact that it was hard to share big files. Like if you had a 10 meg file, novice users don't know about FTP, for instance, and they don't really know how to get web space. So they don't really know how to share a 10 meg file. They send it by email and it doesn't fit in the email. They try to zip it and it doesn't zip if it's full of pictures. So we implemented an application to do that. And now they just right click on the file and upload it. They don't have to worry about FTP or anything and it shares it for them. So it's all about those different things that people have a need for and actually they're still hard to do, hard to achieve. In other operating systems.
So what is the legality surrounding the ability for someone to, or for you to put out what you put out and include codecs for proprietary codecs, or do you include the proprietary codecs? What's the client like over there in Ireland that allows for that, or wherever you host it? Do you have any concern about repercussions from the patent-holding companies?
Well, there's no patents. There's no software patents in Ireland, so it's not a concern.
There's no software patents in Europe in general, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a silly American thing, DMCA.
That's right. I forgot. It's all over you. Europe like that.
It's a different concern, you know. Every country has different legislation, and to say something is legal or not legal it depends which legislation you're looking at. And when you come to software patents, it's even more of a gray area, because like the UK, for instance, is very strongly against software patents. The rest of Europe is kind of it's like it's not really decided yet, and in the US there's legislation to enforce them, so it really depends. But the basic thing is there's no real threat when you look at it, and the only real threat that you can actually see is the potential patent threat by some patent holder. And no matter what you do, no matter what components you actually put in your software, there's going to be a patent against it. There's patents on everything, really. So you can't consider yourself safe from patent threats. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I understand exactly what you're saying. I do. That no matter.
And it's
oh, go ahead.
I don't think it would come from a company like Microsoft, for instance, like looking at us and saying, "Well, you support our Windows codec, so we're not happy with that, and here's a patent threat." They could actually suffer from starting and doing things like that. I think the real threat would come from patent holder companies who have nothing to do with software. Like companies basically buying patents as a money-making industry.
Which is very unfortunate.
Yeah. But again, they can only do that in certain countries, like probably Japan or the U.S.
So then given...
Back to Linux.
Oh, sorry, Pat. I was going to say, given that... is there any issues surrounding including the any closed or proprietary codecs or software and being in compliance with the GPL? I mean, you don't suffer any problems with that, do you? Or do you have to be very careful?
Well, the GPL is very important. And the only problem with the GPL was to include proprietary drivers. And it had to do with linking the drivers... With the kernel, basically. But that's the reason there's no proprietary drivers in Linux Mint. Because again, it's a very gray area. You know, some people say it's all right, some people say it's not. You look at Sabayun and they kind of include them, but they're not linked by default, and it's only when the user starts the operating system that they get linked. So, you know, it's... It's some kind of technical tweak, but it's in the end of the day, it's very much of a gray area. And for the Windows codecs, it had to do with copyrights and DLLs. And the decision in the end was to include them. And for the proprietary drivers, it had to do with the GPL. And the decision was not to include them. And basically, in the end, it doesn't come to legality or patents or copyright. It simply comes from moral values. You know, I look at the GPL and I see a great thing from the Free Software Foundation, and I wouldn't want to go against it, even if it's not black and white. On the other hand, you see people being locked in, like you look at MP3, for instance, and the Windows codecs, and you see the whole world being locked in those proprietary formats. If you look at it from a moral point of view, you had, like, the MP3 format, for instance, was free of cost, and everybody jumped in it. And now everybody has MP3 files and everybody's using them. And same with the DVD, like, I don't find it acceptable to say that now that these formats have been locked in, that we can't use them anymore. So it's legal for us to do that in Ireland. It's probably legal in the US as well, but it's risky in terms of patent threats.
No, it's not. Nothing's legal in the U.S. anymore. It's all illegal.
Is it? Well, is it illegal to read DVDs?
No, not on Linux. It's not. It's not legal to read DVDs. Technically, it's not legal. Well, it's a gray area whether it's legal to actually play MP3 files. But not to read DVDs. Technically, it's illegal. And MPEG-4, which is, I think, the technology MPEG in general is a closed proprietary technology, even though they say it's a quote open standard. It's not. It's patent encumbered, so you have to pay royalties in order to use the MPEG technology, so that's kind of a locked door for us. So not only can we not decrypt the DVDs, we can't even play their contents due to the codec that they're encoded in. So you got the double wackadoo there with being not legal to play them on Linux. Unless you get the... There is a DVD player out there on Linux that gives you the rights in the United States to play it. Unfortunately, it has to be distributed by a company. You have to purchase it through them. I think Linspire might sell it. And I think there's... what is it? Pat, correct me if I'm wrong, but is it the Dell? Ubuntu Dell Systems or somebody that's starting to come out with the DVD playback software?
Yeah, LinDVD, which is now owned by Adobe, apparently.
Yeah, you can't... But consumers can't buy that. You can't go and buy a license for that. But anyway, that's the case in the United States. We're not as cool as Europe, unfortunately. You guys have it right.
Back to Linux Mint, Clement. What are some of the things that you do to make the experience better besides, you know, setting up codecs out of the box? What are some of the other things?
Well, I just want to finish on the codec thing. I think it's all about freedom. But not like, you know, the way we say it's all about freedom of like free software, and I think freedom is more than that. It's for you to do whatever you want with your computer, and when we talk about freedom, it's for us when we distribute our software, it's basically give the choice to the user. Like you look at Ubuntu, they don't ship codecs, for instance, but they make it easy for you to install them. We have two different editions. We have a light edition and a main edition. And so the main edition comes with all those codecs. And for the people who actually don't want to get them, it's the light edition. So the choice is there from day one when you start downloading the edition you're interested in. You know, you can actually use Mint without all that.
So what you're saying here is that you... In your opinion, freedom to you is also the freedom to make the decision of whether or not you want to use proprietary software on your computer.
Yeah.
All right, see, now that's where you and I completely agree. However, there's a fellow by the name of Richard Stallman who has great issues with that.
Well... Yeah, he abides by his own philosophy, and I can't really say anything wrong about him. You know, I've got a lot of admiration for Richard Stallman. But again, I don't agree with him when he starts boycotting, and it's fair enough that somebody wants to boycott proprietary software and decides to restrict his own choice to only use free software. That's fair enough, but. Actually, advocating that and tell people what they can do and what they can't do, I don't think it's right.
Well, sir, you are a freedom hater, just like I am. Welcome to the club.
Thank you.
I warned you and expect a couple of Stallmans being launched at your house right now.
Yeah, I'll probably.
Due to the time zone shifts and the having to fly overseas, they'll be there in about 7 hours.
Yep, here it comes.
Yeah, so we've got the light edition, basically for people who want only free software, and it's not only for this. It's like for magazines and companies who basically want to distribute Linux Mint without taking any risks as well. Like we've got OEMs starting to talk to the distribution and they want to distribute computers with Linux Mint on it. When they're in the US, we basically suggest they go for the light edition. And the same way Ubuntu makes it easy to install those codecs, we come with a Mint package that installs all that. So it basically transforms your light edition into a main edition. So. Again, it depends on your choice, and it depends on as a user, it depends on whether you want them or not, and as a distributor, it depends on whether you want to take the risk or not. So, in additions, and in the future, we're kind of thinking we've got a first-run assistant. First time you actually go on the desktop, it asks you a few questions like, "Do you want a root account and stuff like that?" And we're thinking of putting a new question. basically asking, well, do you want codecs or not? And showing the consequence of having them and blah, blah, blah. And so you just click yes or no, and here you go. You get all the codecs, or you don't.
That's pretty cool. Now, you have versions with different desktops, right? You have a GNOME version. You have a KDE version. You also have a Fluxbox edition, too.
Yeah. The purpose was to make one desktop, basically. So the choice was put on GNOME. But then the community asked for KDE and XFCE and different desktops. And I never had time to do all that. So I basically do Linux Mint on my spare time. So we started those things called the community editions. So it's basically picking someone from the community and start a close relationship with that person and basically create some kind of a team and have people from the community basically take ownership of the development and the maintenance of a special edition. So, for instance, there's somebody called Jamie Boo in Australia, and he's taking care of the KDE community edition. So he's basically talking a lot together, and he developed the KDE edition. We test it together, and we release it. So it's community maintained, but at the same time, it's a Linux Mint ISO in the end. So it's very closely tied to the main edition.
Well, it seems very popular. Just looking at your forum, you have over 5,000 members, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's growing. It's still very small, you know, compared to other distributions.
That's pretty good, 5,000 people on your forum.
It's 5,000 bots.
No. Back to my question from before. What are some of the things that you do besides codecs and drivers and such things? Well, what extra stuff do you have in there to make it easier for people?
We started by putting the codecs basically, and the first step was to rebrand Ubuntu. So for us and for them as well, because it's not good for Ubuntu to have a different product, which actually, you know, with Ubuntu logos and all. So we rebranded it and I did the codec. So that was the first release called Barbara. Then after that, we focused on the system and put a lot of tweaks in there. So basically we disabled IPv6 to make the network faster. We created some kind of package called Mint Wi-Fi. So it's a collection of NDIS wrapper drivers. So it's basically for the user to be able to set up his Wi-Fi connection without access to the internet, provided the driver is supported by Mint Wi-Fi. So it includes dependency on NDIS, GTK, and it's basically a set of drivers and packages to make NDIS wrapper work without an internet connection. What else was there? Many tweaks in Firefox, tweaks, a lot of GNOME tweaks as well. Like, for instance, the ability to open a terminal from anywhere in Nautilus. I don't know what this. I could look at the release notes. I forgot really. But it's a lot of tweaks basically on the system. So that
somebody
was.
Somebody
that
in
was
here actually had a question for you, Clement. They're wondering. Will KDE 4.0 be in the next release of Mint, or will you wait around for 4.1 to be released?
I'm very doubtful about that, and I'd say, well, Jamie would be the man to ask, you know. Like, it's his decision in the end. I know Ubuntu is going to, Kubuntu is going for KDE 4 in the next version. I don't think it's ready, to be honest. I don't know. Again, you can achieve a lot in very small time if you're passionate, you know, so like, why not? I don't know. The KDE guys seem very passionate. Maybe they'll be ready in time, you know. I don't really know.
So you're taking a wait-and-see approach?
Yeah, I think it's a bit too early, to be honest. Like,
yeah,
it depends what you call KDE.
I can understand why people want to wait, you know, some of the distributions. To me, it's understandable why you might want to be a little more conservative in the approach of whether or not to include it or not.
Yeah, it's going to be Jamie's decision, you know. I won't decide on that. But the idea is to give a good desktop to the user. So it's not about having good APIs and a stable KDE framework. It's about having a good KDE desktop. And that includes the new Amarok, the new Contact, the new, you know, all these applications. They have to be ready. You can't release a KDE desktop with a brand new KDE and no application supported. It doesn't work, you know. It's like, no one's interested in that. Like, don't get me wrong. Look at what KDE 4 is about and what they've done, and it looks really promising. You know, it looks very, very good. But it's not something you're gonna install on your parents' computers. Do you know, it's not usable yet.
Yeah, not for another year or so.
Maybe less. Maybe a little less. We'll see how 4.1 shapes up.
Yeah, hopefully it'll come in 4.0, but I don't really know. I don't know if it'll come in 4.0 and then applications will gradually come as well, and then it'll be up to distributors to actually put all that together. Or if KDE is going to release a 4.1 with everything ready in it, I don't really know.
Okay.
So as far as, like, user requests, Clement, have you got any specific feedback that people have come back to you of other things they might want added in besides what you have already?
Yeah, there's constant feedback, and that's the reason why we succeed, basically. All the things we developed, you can look through the forums, and there's been people asking for it, or, you know, giving us ideas, and they're doing all the work, really, when you think of it. Nearly all the innovations come from the forum, people giving ideas and describing things.
Well, what are some of the things that you've implemented based on user feedback?
Well, there's different kind of feedback. There's bug reports, for instance, like people telling us that their system crashed, and that was. Like, because of some upgrade, and so they come to the forum and they tell you, well, my system crashed, and it was just after I upgraded my system, and you're like, well, which upgrade did you take? And they're like, well, I don't really know, I just installed all of them, you know. So we came up with that, we looked at it, and we realized that some updates were actually harmful to the system. Like, for instance, if you have an NVIDIA card and you install a new kernel, the bindings between your driver and the kernel get broken, so you can end up with breaking your display, for instance. So you could use Linux Mint or Ubuntu, take all the upgrades, reboot, and then you've got no graphical display anymore, or your Wi-Fi doesn't work, and that was a big problem. So we removed the update manager that Ubuntu had, and we developed our own, and we defined those level of stability, basically. So for each package in the repository, we assign a number, basically, to define whether an upgrade is safe or not. And the user has a choice of defining which levels he wants to apply by default, and which ones he wants to see or not to see. So he's got greater control over his updates management, basically.
Now, you've designed your own package management interface, correct? Something that's like custom?
Yeah, we simplified the way software is installed, yeah. But it's an idea coming from PCBSD with the PBI directory, you know. Like, you browse a website, for instance, or even CNR from Linspire. You browse a website, and you just click on what you want to install, and then you click next, 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 and it's installed. So You know, you don't have to go and you don't have to know the package name for the application you want. You just search for it. You get screenshots, user feedback, little mini reviews. Just clicking install. But the only difference is that the CNR and PBI use static packages. So what you actually download is the whole application itself. Whereas with the thing we developed is basically it's like a web layer on top of APT. So it's a mint file. So it's basically like a 100K file. And it's made of text files, which basically tell APT where to get the package and which repository to use. So, for instance, you want to install VirtualBox, for instance. No, actually, that's in the default repositories now. Let's say you want to install something that's not in your repository. You just go on the software portal. You just click on Firefox. You click install. And that's going to download a tiny little file. And within that file, it's going to tell your APT package manager to add those two repositories, for instance, to set up the keys for them, to download those three packages, and then to revert your sources.list to the way it was before. So you basically end up with your software installed, and you don't have to worry about repositories or keys or whatever.
Now, you also have like a level setting, right? How much the user wants to trust different repositories and packages?
Oh, in the update manager, yeah.
Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, like there's five levels basically, and the tools we develop ourselves and that we test ourselves, we give them a level of one, and they're basically trusted packages. Ubuntu package have a level of 3, and then the Ubuntu package that we actually test get a level of 2. So the higher the level, the less safe the upgrade is, basically. It's like us giving some guarantee to the user for each package that appears in the upgrade manager as to whether it's stable on us and whether it was tested on us by us. So, for instance, a new kernel. If Ubuntu releases a new kernel in Gutsy, it's going to get a level 5 in Linux Mint. So unless you change the preferences in the update manager, you won't see that update. So basically, novice user won't see that update, and they won't get the new kernel. And so we can test that new kernel, see that it doesn't break anything. We have people more adventurous than others who'd get those upgrades even though they're level 5. And if there are problems, they report them on the forum. And we basically get to know if packages are safe to upgrade or not. And depending on that, we can change the level. So you've got Ubuntu releasing a new package, defaulting level 3. Somebody reports a problem with it. We change the level to level 4. And then consequently, other people are not going to see that upgrade if they don't trust level 4 packages. Or, you know, it's some kind of filtering on top of the update manager.
So is this a way for, like, the Windows user who comes over to Linux for the first time to make them feel a little more, you know, secure about it, especially since they don't have to run virus software and spy bot search and destroy or anything like that on the Linux system?
No, well, it's nothing to do with Windows users. It's for Linux users basically. There's a risk in taking updates. The reason you get updates in Ubuntu basically is for security holes. So for every update you get better security, but you know yourself, with every change you can introduce new bugs. And nothing is more tested than a release. So the basic ISO that you download from Ubuntu or from Linux Mint is very well tested. When you apply updates to that, you change your system to something that's not as well tested, and you can basically introduce bugs. So it's basically a way for us to catch buggy updates, and you know, and and to change the visibility of these updates depending on the users.
How do you do your testing?
It's basically take the updates and then see that everything's running again. And for me, we are talking two or three computers, but then it's again, it's the whole community reporting things on the forums all the time. Like, for instance, if there's a new version of Opera, or a new version of the GIMP, for instance, you know it's not going to affect your system because it's a one single application. So you can take the upgrade, just test the software, see that it works fine, and that upgrade is relatively safe. If you've got a kernel upgrade, or a dbus, or a HAL storage, or you know some kind of system lib library or something, that can potentially break a lot of things. And some packages are left with level 3, basic level of non-tested but trusted by Ubuntu. And some other package, by their nature, they're going to be level 4 by default because they're potentially risky.
There was a recent breakage with some Xorg packages a few days ago. They were resolved pretty quickly, but, you know, some people, you know, who updated the packages had problems with certain types of applications.
Yeah, see, that's a very good example because you don't want everybody to get that Xorg thing. You want only adventurous people to get it. And then they report the fault. And you know what I mean? People trust what they see. If they see a new package, they're going to install it. Most people don't even look at it. You never really look at the jetlog. It's every update that comes.
So for basically what you're saying, for the vast majority of people, all these updates, the latest and greatest of a lot of packages, aren't really necessary.
Oh, no, they are. The security issues in all these packages, and that's why they get upgraded. So they are, but it's all about stability versus security, and you have to know which one to value most. And for me anyway, the choice is made that I'm targeting desktop users. Not servers, not production systems. So I want the system to be stable, and even more so than secure.
So how is the bug reporting feedback from your users? Is it really good?
Yeah, but it's very informal. There's not a lot done. Like basically, think of it as there's five levels. And if you don't change the preferences, you see level 1, 2, and 3. Every single Ubuntu package is defaulting to level 3. And then we've got maybe 10 or 11 packages that go in level 4, like system packages, basically.
What does level 3 mean?
It basically means safe packages, not tested, but believed to be safe.
Oh, okay. Okay. So how much work do you have to put into Linux Mint? And I mean, is that your primary job?
No, I do it in my spare time. So it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time.
You must have a very loving and understanding wife.
Yeah. I'm starting that. I've got a very flexible company as well, so it's good. And they use core time and flexi time. So I'm starting thinking of maybe going to work from 7 to 3, and then 3 to 6 doing Linux Mint, and you know, like partitioning my time so that it doesn't eat my family time as well.
So how many other developers do you have working with you?
There's about. There's about 15 people altogether, and there's very different backgrounds. There's maintainers, developers, there's community leaders, forum moderators, it's different people, really.
So, Combat, I have a question for you. How did you get started with Linux, and what was your first distribution that you used?
It was Slackware. It was in 1997. I can't even remember how I got it. I was in university and somebody had we were using Unix AIX on our servers, and it was pretty bad. But even though it was so bad, in terms of desktop experience, the system was very stable, and you could see how the architecture was very likable. And here came Linux as floppy disks, and it was Slackware at the time, and you couldn't even make your mouse work. But the system was great, and you had file permissions and multi-user and all those network tools. It was really, really good. So I started with that. And I used Slackware for a good while. And then after that, I started distro hopping. And I took great interest in Linux, so I was always reading websites and trying different distributions.
So when are we going to see Linux Mint on top of Slackware again?
Well, some people talked about that, yeah. I don't really see the great thing about Debian is the package management. And I would miss that a lot if I had to go away from it.
Well, Slackware now has package management with Swaret or Slapdget or... What's the other one? I thought there was a third one. But you're right, though. The Debian package manager is out of this world. I think light years ahead of all the other package managers out there. What's your opinion of RPM?
Well, RPM is just the package format, but it's actually very good. And there's a lot of package managers, and I think Yum is the Fedora, the one using Fedora. It's actually very, very good. Can't remember the name of the one used by OpenSUSE, but it's got, I think it actually has more features, and it's actually, it looks better than APT, but it's nowhere near as fast, and it's not as efficient. I remember using Yum, for instance, in Fedora, and I thought, wow, that's great, you can do this, and you can do that, and it's very well developed, you know. But at the same time, it was really, really slow. And the GUIs that were working with it were not as advanced as Synaptic, for instance. So, yeah, I don't know. I always go back to APT, basically.
Have you ever used Pac-Man? Which is the
No,
Arch?
I never tried that. That's in Arch Linux, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I think it's really nice. But
yeah, it's very good. I think it's at least on par with apt-get. I mean, personally, I love the Debian-based systems. Those are my favorites right now. But Arch Linux is a very nice distribution, and Pac-Man is a fantastic package management system.
I heard a lot of good things about Arch Linux. I haven't tried it yet.
Well, it's definitely not a newbie distro, that's for sure. It's for people who know what they're doing and know what they want to do.
True. True. It's a little more
again,
difficult.
If it's got a solid base, you never know. Like, you look at Debian and you could have said the same, 3 years ago, and said Debian was for very advanced users. And look what Ubuntu's done with it. And even now Linux Mint is one of the easiest desktop to use as well, so... If it's got a great base, and the system tools are easy to use and very efficient, it's not a big job to actually make the desktop more usable.
I think it's a little more difficult to make the install more usable for Arch. That's probably the only kind of drawback, I think, with it. It's a very simple system at the heart of it, but who the hell am I kidding? Simple to me is not going to be simple for the average user. you know, who's never done, you know, editing text files from a command line is pretty much the way it works. It's real, but it's very simplistic and basic compared to some of the other distributions that if you tried to manage them from command line without their utilities and tools would find a lot more difficult. But it is a solid distribution, has a pretty good population of users, and that'd be interesting to see if you could get it, Linux Mint stuff up and running on that.
Is it based on Slackware?
No. It's derived from, well,
originally it was Crux,
yeah,
but they broke away from that.
If I'm not mistaken, I thought Crux was an offshoot of Slackware, and they developed a package management system for Crux, which differentiated it from Slackware, and then Arch branched off of that.
Because I remember, and people get amazed when I say that, that, you know, they don't believe it, but I remember Slackware was very, very easy to use. And not in a way, you know, it didn't have any graphical config tools or anything. It wasn't focused on developing tools and configuration tools, but the text files and the configuration and the even the file system and where the files were and the init system, everything was very, very simple. And you looked at any file in /etc, it was documented, it had comments everywhere. It was very, very easy to use. And when you moved from there to a system like Red Hat, for instance, I always found it really hard to use, you know, even though it had all those graphical tools on top of it. So...
Yeah, that's the way it is, you know, because, again, I find Slackware very easy to use and to manage and administer, so Arch is right up there in same kind of concept that Slackware uses, and it's very simplistic and straightforward, but then again,
except with a kick-ass package management system.
Right, but again, a lot of people don't appreciate that kind of management. And I can understand that.
Yeah, that was the only problem I had with it, basically, is that... I could have used Swarite and what's the other one? Slaptiget, is it? But yeah, you basically had to deal with PKG add or even compile your own TGZ files, like basically, you know, unpack something and compile it and then make install. But at the same time, the system was very tidy and everything was at the right place. Configuration files were very easy to use. The system didn't change overnight, you know, it was very stable. But I've got very good memories with Slackware.
I'm with you, Clement. I feel the same exact way about Slackware. It was a very nice distro, it was cool, I used it, but I wanted a package manager.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on. How dare you? What do you mean, dot configure? Make install is not a package manager. It's the best you could have. A couple of questions about Linux Mint. Shoot, there was one I was going to ask a second. All right. How did you come up with the name Linux Mint?
I knew you were going to ask that, and I don't have an answer. I don't really know. Well, I got the name before I wanted to do the distribution. I was writing reviews for linuxforums.org, linuxforums.org or .com. I was writing reviews for them, I was making money by selling those articles basically. And eventually, I decided to try and publish them myself. And so I just needed a .com and a website, and called linuxmint.com. And I can't even remember the reason, but it, I think it had to do with the vanilla kernels, and you know the way when a kernel is not touched, you say it's a vanilla kernel, and I don't know the penguins in the in the North Pole and the ice creams. I don't really know. It's just Linux Mint sounded cool, and it was, you know, just a few letters. It was good.
Good enough. Next question. what does Linux Mint ship with a big ass analog clock?
Not yet.
That's a requirement for Dan's distributions. Any Linux distro, Dan needs a big analog clock that takes up half the screen.
At least a third. I'll accept a third, but preferably a half or more. And no numbers. If you can put no numbers on the face of the clock and give it a little beveled edge or something to make it look nice, that is prime usability right there.
Do you want it free or proprietary?
Well, we talked about that earlier. I think that should display itself in binary until you unlock it with the code. And then it can display its analog beauty. How much would you charge for that license, for the clock?
Well, for the full digital feature? Or
So you're going to do it a tiered licensing. And will it be in euros, or can we actually have the conversion done for us lazy people in the United States into the U.S. dollars?
Are you serious about the clock? Do you think you need a clock or?
He's sarcastic.
No, I absolutely hate a big analog clock. I think it's ridiculous. And I don't see a place for an analog clock on a computer desktop. That's just my opinion.
But where did you see what? You're talking about the one in Vista, is it? Or?
Well, there's one in Vista. There's one on the GOS operating system, which is has a big analog clock on the side. It's a big analog clock with... I don't think it... Let me look here. Hold on. I still have it up and running. So I can entertain my analog clock fix.
It's a big analog clock
without any numbers on it.
Some of the early screenshots of KDE 4.0, they had the analog plasmoid. Widget.
But that's just as the demonstration of the plasmoid, is it?
It's not on by default, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people say, no way the clock changed. I don't think the clock should be there to begin with. It's a computer. It's digital. It's supposed to make my life easier, not make me think. Right? Right, Link?
Link is sleeping.
Absolutely.
I'm just not a fan of the analog clock. Sorry.
It's a good example. You know, again, you should have more choice, and it should be configurable. So it shouldn't be activated by default if it's going to annoy somebody, but it should be there. You know, if you want it, and you should be able to right click on it and say, "Well, I want the digital one." But you get that. Like I've got GNOME in front of me. I'm sure there's an applet for that. Clock. At clock.
The GPC doesn't use GNOME. It uses Enlightenment 17, E17. So I don't have an analog clock on my GNOME system. I don't have an analog clock on the KDE system. I don't even have an analog clock on my Fluxbox system. And I don't see an analog clock on Linux Mint. Therefore, there shouldn't be an analog clock. Unless I want to physically put one on there. By choice. That's just my opinion. And obviously it should be yours, too.
I agree with the fact that the default setting should be pleasant. And so it's not about just the fact that you can remove the clock. If it's not nice, it shouldn't be there by default. But I haven't seen anything like that in any distribution.
Well, I would gladly send you a picture of the GOS desktop because it's there. And I'm not saying it doesn't, like, maybe look nice sometimes. It's just, I don't see it. I just don't see it.
Dan's going to get hate mail from all the big-ass analog clock supporters out there.
That's right. So we already got, well, why are you complaining about the one on Vista when KDE 4 has one? Well, I don't know. I don't like
it's
it
not on by default.
I just... You know what? You know, that's a damn good question. And I never took notice of this, because I know on Windows, on Vista Desktop, or on Windows by itself, has a clock in the system tray. Now, does it have both the analog clock in that little obnoxious panel on the side and a digital clock in the system tray, and that is asinine. And you know what? If you are out there, anybody out there using Vista, I'd be very interested, one, to know if that's the case, and two, to know whether they're both showing the same time. Because I could see that one of them would be off in some way, and that would just be perfect. That would explain everything about how Vista runs if they were both out of sync. It would be hilarious. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I killed the conversation.
You're wrong.
No one knows what to say after
I'm
that.
Sorry. What are you going to do? Oh. So what do you what do you do most of your development using for Linux Mint? I mean, is it just like pulling together packages, or do you actually do you modify source code to make things and tweak stuff and patch, or do you add your own packages, like own customized software in the Linux Mint, or is it just the packaging of software in a particular way?
There's a bit of everything, really. Like there's configuration. So it's basically going on the file system and changing config files. Then there's patching done as well on some packages. For instance, we have Tomboy nodes, and it pops up by default. So we change the source code to change the behavior. We've rebranded Firefox, so we changed the source code for that as well. So there's a bit of patching. Or for XChat, when you launch XChat, it connects directly to the chat room, and because XChat doesn't let you configure that in an external configuration file, you have to change the source code for it to do that. So there's a bit of patching. There's a different selection of software as well. So for instance, to achieve the fact that you can open a terminal from anywhere in GNOME, that's just done by installing a little package that's in the repository. And then there's development of new software. So for instance, the menu is called Mint Menu, and it's developed by us. The update manager is our own tool as well. There's a Mint install that handles the whole installation of packages. There's something called Mint Desktop which is basically some kind of configuration tool to configure GNOME settings that you can't configure by default in GNOME, such as change the Nautilus behavior to open a window for each folder or stuff like that. So there's a lot of things, really. There's a lot of different ways to do things, and it's not always done through packaging.
Okay, that's understandable. That's cool. I mean, you do an awesome job. It's an awesome project, and it's making so many people happy and turned on to actually using Linux systems as a desktop, and you should be commended for that fantastic effort that you're doing. Have you have any companies approached you about maybe using Linux Mint on any systems? Because I know we're seeing a lot of embedded in small form factor devices using Linux. Has anybody approached you about that?
No, for embedded devices, no.
Or something, like on low end computers to spice up a rather drab desktop to say, hey, let's, get Linux Mint rolling on here and make it a little more easy and usable and get these things rolling.
There's more and more OEM companies, basically, like PC resellers and distributors interested in installing Linux Mint on their computers. And so there's a growing number of emails about that. But again, it's all free and open source, so it's they don't need us, they don't need me or Linux Mint to actually say, yeah, sure, go ahead. So I don't see everything that's happening.
They might not need you to say yeah or yes, but they should probably tap you as an excellent resource for support, and to be able to roll stuff back to you. That would be a nice benefit. Like maybe some money or financing, donations, aside from suggestions and bug fixes.
Yeah, it's up to them, really. And we've got a very open way to do partnerships. And basically the way it works is if you're a company and you want to roll out Linux Mint on your computers, you come to us and people basically ask you, they usually ask, well, is it all right? And we say, sure, there's no problem and there's no cost involved. It's free. Like basically you can change it and do whatever you want to it. Or even rebrand it. You can deploy it if you want. But we can increase the OEM sales as well by having a partnership and so basically if the company donates to Linux Mint on a regular basis they become something called a sponsor and so they have their name on the website and you know they have their company name associated with the success of Linux Mint so again everybody wins from their relationship. And it's not something I've looked into very much, but I'm sure it's going to work over time. You know, the more people do that, the more interest is going to be in that area.
That'd be really cool to see more and more of that. How is the in Ireland? How is free software market in Ireland? Is it doing well? Is it being used by companies, the government, people in general, or is it still a Windows world over there like it is in the US?
It's very much Windows. Although you're starting to see, if you go to a cyber cafe, you're starting to see OpenOffice and Firefox is all over the place. You're starting to see OpenOffice replacing Microsoft Office. And they're still using it on top of Windows operating systems, but you're starting to see cyber cafes and people in their house, and even within the company, people starting to use open source software.
So what about your family? Do they use Linux Mint?
Yeah.
That's good. When you get the support from your family to do that, that makes life a whole lot better. So are all your systems there at home at your house running Linux Mint?
Well, there's a bit of R&D as well. So I've got Fedora on one of the partitions, and I'm testing things as well. You know, when there's a new release, I want to know about the new features. The one thing I thought was wrong with distributions before I started Linux Mint was the fact that they couldn't learn from each other, and you could see great things achieved in Mondriva, for instance, and new release of Ubuntu coming up right afterwards. Without those features, there's great innovations done by the SUSE team, for instance. Fedora is very innovative as well. Ubuntu is, but they don't seem to learn from each other, and that's not something we do here. Like if I see something good in a distribution, or even in Windows or Mac OS, if it's good for the user and if it actually improves the desktop, then I want it to be in the next release of Linux Mint. So it's as simple as that. Like, for instance, the Mondriva had those folders created by default in your home directory. So right off the box, when you started Mondriva and you went in your home directory, you had documents and videos and downloads and all those little directories. And it's a very simple thing, but I thought it was great the way it was done. And the folders had different colors and... You can delete those folders, you know, if you don't like them, but they are there for people to feel at home and put their files in a tidy manner, you know, from scratch, basically. And it took a while, like, the minute I saw that at the Dynamics Mint, but it took a while for the distributions to actually implement that, and they're starting to do it with something called XDG, DIR or something. And still they're not using the labels and the emblems in GNOME, so it's still not there. And it's something that was started by Mondriva, but I don't know, about 2 years ago.
I hear you there. That is something. What part of Ireland do you live in?
Right in the middle.
Right in the middle,
Midland.
Huh?
Yeah.
Is it like really cold over there right now?
No, it's an island, so it's always kind of temperate.
Uh huh.
It's not too bad. It rains all the time, though.
Well,
I'm gonna get killed now for saying that.
So, what's your day job like? I mean, if you can talk about that, what do you do for a living?
Yeah, I'm a Java developer.
Oh, that's neat.
It's interesting.
Now, do you
what do you use for your IDE for Java? If you don't mind asking.
At work.
Yeah, what do you use?
Eclipse,
yeah. I like Eclipse too.
It's very good platform.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool plugins you can use with it.
Yeah, we're starting to use the Eclipse framework as well with RCP and development. So it's very interesting.
You know, I heard today that the new version of Zen Studio, which is a PHP development IDE, is going to be built on top of Eclipse.
It's a very flexible platform. It's amazing how much you can achieve with it.
I just always found it hellish to set up.
Well, the thing is, Dan, you got to know what you want to do with it, and then you go out and you get the plugins that'll let you do that. There's plugins where you could do, you know, for the most part, it's a Java development IDE, but there are other plugins for other languages. For instance, the Python plugin, PyDev, is excellent. I've been using that quite a bit lately.
It's flexible. It's actually not an IDE. It's an API. It's like a whole framework. And by default, it comes with plugins. The Eclipse that you actually download is a set of plugins on top of Eclipse, which actually make the Java IDE. So it's. But yeah, you can use it for Python with I think it's for PyDev, and plus environmental CD something. It's very, very good. And you can develop your own plugins as well. So you can basically do anything you want with it.
You know what Linux Mint needs? It just reminded me, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I don't want to forget this. What Linux Mint needs, when you were talking about plugins, and I have not found this at all under Linux, and I should write one myself. But anyway, it needs a little application that you can run to determine where you're going to go for lunch that day. So that... The only place I've ever seen this was on there's a Windows application that does this, but I've seen it. It was a Mac, an OS X. What is that crappy thing that they have? Alan, you know what I'm talking about. What's the little thing that runs the widgets on OS X?
The thing that runs the widgets?
That has the widgets on it. It's the dashboard. The dashboard.
There's
a dashboard widget that'll allow you to, it'll randomly choose based upon restaurants that you put in. But what we were thinking about the other day at work is we were going to write one that interacts with the Google Maps API and references all the restaurants in a couple block radius from where you are located and randomly chooses one that you could go to. That's what I want to see out of Linux Mint. And until Linux Mint produces that, I can't recommend it.
And the clock.
Yes. And
you're gonna stick with OS X, Dan, huh?
That's right. I'm going to write
You're going to stay with OS X until that
happens. That's it.
Right?
Alan will stay with OS X until that gets rectified.
I've really never had to worry about going out to lunch and where to pick, so.
Why? Right, because nobody invites you, you sorry bastard.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Alan's
such a loner.
Alan's the guy that sits in the corner eating his lunch out of a paper bag all by himself, and people walk by and they give him that wide berth and they sneer at him and they're like, "Shh, that's the guy I was telling you about," and they point at him and giggle, and then he just mopes back to his desk.
Get the red stapler.
And
I have a maroon one.
And he sits out in the parking lot at the end of the day on his Goldwing, revving the engine as people go by, giving them dirty looks like, vroom, vroom, vroom. And they say, Alan.
There's only one problem with that, Dan. Revving the engine on the Goldwing doesn't make any noise.
Is it like driving a hybrid when the electric motor kicks in?
It does make noise, but it doesn't make any vroom, vroom loud ones. It's pretty quiet.
Sorry, but That's what I want to see on Linux Mint, and I apologize. You guys can go back to talking about your Java love.
Fedora is looking into web experience to the desktop, and I don't really see the potential yet. They have a better vision than I do with that, but they're looking at bringing web services to the desktop. So like that, they were talking about mugshot and stuff like that. But I'm sure if they make it extensible enough, you'll have people starting developing little applets or plugin, and probably things like you described. But it's basically an application which connects to a web service.
Did that answer your question, Pat?
I guess.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Dan.
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I had nothing.
I was just going to thank Clement for getting up in the middle of the night, his time, and talking to us. I really appreciate it.
Did you actually go
Clement
to bed yet?
Been great.
No, well, I had a nap for an hour, yeah.
Oh,
well,
man.
No, thanks. I'm very glad to be here. I listen to you guys, at least once a week. Okay, once a week, and
if you listen to us more than once a week, man, holy man. do you have to go to an office to work, or do you actually get to work from home, telecommute?
No, in an office, yeah.
So you gotta be at work at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Well, I can go at 9:30, yeah.
Wow, 7 a.m. How far away is work from where you live?
4 minutes.
Oh, well, I don't feel so bad for you. Yeah. Is that driving or walking?
Driving.
So what is it, like 10 minutes walking?
I don't know.
I've never done it.
Yeah, I take the bicycle sometimes.
Now, just curious here, and you don't have to answer this question if you want, but I used to work 10 minutes away from where I lived, and my routine for getting up and going to work in the morning was basically rolling out of bed, rolling into my clothes after I brushed my teeth, and going right to work. So I would get up like 25 minutes before I needed to get to work, and 10 minutes later I was out the door, and 15 minutes later I was at work. Since you're 4 minutes away, I mean, how long does it take you to get ready in the morning? Do you just like roll out of bed and roll right to work?
Yeah.
That's the way to do it.
It's basically having a shower and putting on the clothes and yeah. Yeah, I don't really know where I am when I get up in the morning. So basically get up at 9 and I'm there at 9:30.
Wait,
but I want to change that. So, like I spend a lot of time on Linux Mint, and I've got two little kids at home. And I've been doing that a lot, with them watching TV and the TV in the background, the kids, and spending time on the laptop. And nobody's happy. Like I don't get to do much because they're here, and I don't spend too much time with them because the laptop's here. And so I'm starting to change that, and I really want now to do Linux Mint from 3 to 6, for instance, 3 times, 3 hours nonstop, no disruption. And then park the laptop, turn off everything, and have my family life after that. So it involves now getting up earlier in the morning, going to work at 7, leaving at 3, and it's basically work time and then Linux Mint time and then family time basically.
Well, that's good because you don't want to sacrifice the family time. That's really important.
Yeah, it's important. Yeah.
Or else wacky things start to happen.
And they're only little ones, they grow fast.
Yeah, it's a very interesting group as well. So, and it was different. So you could spend your whole life on the laptop, just answering emails, developing stuff, looking at distributions, selection of different packages, new developments. It's like you could never stop, if. So you have to draw a line and say, well, that's it for the day. And
yeah, that's true. That
I agree.
True.
I agree with you. You got to learn when to walk away.
Even as a user,
when to hold them and when to fold them.
Even as a user, I don't know if you do a lot of distro hopping, but there's a new release every day. You look at Distro Watch every day. There's new releases every day. You could download them and try them out, and and then you go on osnews.com and then Engadget, or, you know, there's so many websites that, I mean, you just never stop, like. It's a very interesting area, and, you know, there's a lot of content, so yeah, you have to draw a line and say, no more.
Yeah, I know. I hear what you're saying. Sometimes it's hard, you know, to balance that whole family life, work life, and getting to actually do the stuff that you want to do in the Linux
talking
world.
To the microphone.
I am. I'm talking down through the microphone, and I'm talking very low. I might be close, but I'm just actually talking really low. Anyway, I understand. I hear you. But it's true. You know, the kids, they're only young once, and if you don't pay them enough attention, they go crazy and start to eat you at the middle of the night, like unfed cats. You don't want that to happen. Do you have cats?
Virginia's touched you down there, hasn't it?
What?
Virginia has touched you.
Your children are cannibal?
Worrying about your kids eating you in the middle of the night.
I live in the middle of redneck heaven down here. Anything's going to happen. I'll tell you, the first week I was down here, every night, we when you drive out at about like 9, 10 o'clock at night, invariably you'd see one or two shirtless fat men running down the middle of the highway. So, you know,
it's like an episode of Cops.
Yeah, it's crazy. They're like running down that strip of grass in the middle of the hallway, no shirt. Then it's like they're moving.
Totally Dan realized it was an exercise club.
Yeah, I don't know what was going on, but it provides endless entertainment. But yeah, family is important. What else Pat?
Well, I was going to say, Clement, thanks for coming on the show again.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. You're always welcome. you could stay on with us while we chit-chat about other things, but I totally understand if you want to go to bed. It's the middle of the night.
I keep doing a fantastic job on Linux, man. Wonderful.
Well, I don't mind. Like, I'm fully awake now, so there's no problem at all. Yeah, I'll stay with you guys, if you don't mind.
Oh, that's no problem at all. Did anybody have? We didn't discuss topics. Other topics we were going to talk about. Did anybody have anything they wanted to bring up? Or
I had a couple things.
All right, because you know, I'll also talk about the EverX GPC over here, since I haven't talked about it on this.
I noticed. I'm not going to talk about KDE 4.0 per se, but I noticed that they now have versions that run on Windows and Mac OS X. So that's pretty interesting. There's an article from Mars Technical that talks about it, and I'll put that in the RSC. People can check that out.
What's your opinion on that?
Me?
Yeah, or any of you guys. I mean, how do you feel about?
I don't. Hey, listen, man. They give them a taste, and if they want more, give them the real thing.
Hey, crack dealers! Wow.
Yeah, that's it, man. You ease them in.
First taste is always free.
Yeah,
exactly.
I don't know. I respect
except in this case, if they go all out, man, it's all free.
It still stays free, yeah.
Well, I'd be interested in if that actually gains any traction. I'm not sure that would really. I mean, do you really think that it would encourage adoption of Linux? You really think that would happen?
Well, if they got somebody who checks it out and really likes it, maybe they'd be willing to investigate, you know, seeing what it's like on a full-blown, you know, native Linux system.
Now, see, now I don't know what your extent of your experience there, Alan, or Link, with OS X, I've had...
My guess is pretty extensive.
For Alan?
For both of them.
Well, see, now, I remember back in the day when I was drinking the Apple Kool-Aid, and I was under my misunderstanding.
Apple
and Clement, do you have any experience with OS X?
I have to get my hands on it, actually. I'd like to just give you a try. IP is all about.
Okay, so
I really
that's a no. So you don't have any experience with OS X. And now, I
had any
Okay. Now, I don't know what you guys have done with OS X, but I was running, actually, KDE on OS X for a little while using the Darwin ports and some of the other software, and it was a huge pain in the ass because there was... you couldn't really use KDE and OS X at the same time. Obviously, you had to switch between the two. It was kludgy, and at that point, it just was switching over to, instead of using KDE, you use the applications that I would use, like Conqueror or some of the other applications that I use under Linux that weren't available natively for OS X through the Darwin ports and on the X server. And because the X server wasn't integrated into Aqua, they were two separate systems, it was just a... it was kind of a kludge. It was doable, but it was still a kludge. And it made things significantly slower. It was more of a pain in the butt than it was enjoyable, so to speak. But in the end there, I found myself primarily using all the applications that I use on a regular basis on my Linux system through OS X on the X server and not really using the Aqua and OS X native applications. So that was my experience with running KDE on a non-Nix desktop. It was a bit of a pain, but I'd be interested to see if it gains any traction and if it gains any popularity. I mean, there's been talk in the past about companies utilizing Qt or GTK because it is a portable framework that'll run under OS X Linux, Windows, BSD, for creating applications, but that hasn't really taken off yet. Maybe this is the germination of it all. Who knows? That's my two cents, which really amounts to nothing.
GTK is working fine in Windows.
Yes,
I have the gamepad at work, and it's you don't see any difference. No, that's your Linux.
No, but you know. It would be great, though, if companies would adopt something like that to create cross-platform applications utilizing GTK or Qt or something.
Yeah, Qt is definitely, you know, Trolltech is definitely pushing Qt to do that to a large degree now.
I would like to see that. Yeah, the GIMP runs extraordinarily well under Windows. Even under OS X, they have the native port under OS X now. That was running a lot better the last time I used OS X, which was about a year and a half ago. But I still prefer to run it under Linux myself. So this is
same thing with Audacity. Audacity runs in Windows as well. I think it also runs in Mac too. No.
Yeah, they have an OS X port. It runs on all operatings. There's a handful of cross-platform applications that just run extraordinarily well.
And MPlayer is on Windows now, too. So is VLC, now that I think about it.
Well, VLC and MPlayer, they run on Windows and OS X. And if I'm not mistaken, I think FFmpeg does also. Or maybe it runs under OS X and Linux and not Windows. I think there's a port of FFmpeg for Windows. I could be wrong, though. I'm sure somebody will pop up in the IRC and tell us that we're wrong.
But then you want to talk about the EverX machine?
Sure, I'll talk a little bit about the EverX machine. I'll give it the love and lack of love that may or may not have. I got the EverX machine right before the Christmas holiday, and I didn't set it up until the following weekend. And we've been playing around with it off and on. And by and large, if you read my postings on my blog, if you listen to Logger, we talk about the hardware specification for this. The price tag on the EverX machine that was sent to me is not the $299 one. I think it's, what, the $350 one I said. They've thrown in an extra 512 megs of RAM and a NVIDIA GeForce 6200 card with 256 megabytes of video RAM on it, primarily to play WoW. That's what they wanted me to review this thing, playing WoW. I would safely assume that the video card on there is not capable of running 3D graphics, although I haven't pulled out the NVIDIA card and tested this yet, which I plan to do. But given that, you know, you're looking at a $350 machine to play WoW on, somewhere between $350 and $400, which they were interested in seeing, how I felt that it actually ran for playing WoW. My experience on playing WoW under this machine, World of Warcraft, was very positive. It was playable. I had fun playing it. I was not at all... I did not experience any dropouts. I could display the frame rates, and although the frame rates were not spectacular, at running at 25 to 30 frames per second on the lower settings at 800 by 600 resolution, 800 by 600 pixels of resolution, while it might not have been the best looking way to play WoW, it was still more than I thought adequate. I wasn't at all disappointed. I had a fun time. I had some solid play for a good 10 hours. And I gave it two thumbs up. I increased the graphics and the settings on there. I bumped it up to 1024 by 768, increased the graphics capability. That pretty much halved the frame rate. So I was running at, it was reporting at 15 to 17 frames per second. I didn't notice that much of a lag or a difference. I didn't play it too long on that level. I haven't had the time to explore that to any great degree. It still seemed playable to me. Maybe a little choppier than it was before, but I cannot say that it interfered with my enjoyment of the system. When we received this machine, I had my daughter Paige set it up by following the directions. It came with one double-sided... kind of, I would, for lack of a better word, we'll call it a little poster that had the picture of the EverX GPC, the front and back on one side, and gave you a little diagram of where to hook the system up at. And on the other side, it presented you with a display of the desktop, the GPC desktop, and gave you a little number indication as to what it is or what the different sections were. Following the diagrams and just the color coding on the back of the GPC, my daughter was able to easily set this thing up, no problems. One of the confusing parts, and if you look at my blog posting, I have the pictures of the machine up there and the scans of this in these instructions. It comes with a modem in there. So where they tell you to connect the internet, it says, connect to internet, must use Ethernet cable to get online, except they show you a picture of plugging a phone cable into the modem. They even point to the modem that's on the machine, and it comes with a little postcard-sized card in there that says, the modem is not yet usable. It's for developers who are interested in trying to get the modem to be workable under the operating system. So I would assume it is some type of WIN modem. I didn't look into it. Anyway... regardless of the fact that it's a little difficult to see where to plug the network or the Ethernet cable into, there is only one plug you could actually put it into. It's not where they indicate on the instructions, but it should not be hard to find, largely because it will only fit in one location. And that's right above the USB ports, right next to the audio jacks for the sound card. So that was the only little bit of confusion that was pretty much thrown my daughter's way. Aside from that, and having the video, a separate video card in there, which is not shown on the instructions, obviously, they show just the standard system. I just had to indicate to her that, use the video card next to the modem that's installed in the AGP slot, not the video input on the board, motherboard, on the side next to the keyboard jacks interface right there. So the PS2 port, sorry about that. So the setup for her was relatively simple. She didn't have too much of a problem. And getting into GOS and starting to use it the first time was not too difficult. Her comments about it was that it was a little different. A whole lot different than what she's been accustomed to, but was not difficult to pick up. It is based on Enlightenment 17. And the desktop itself is crisp and flashy and was pretty responsive on the system. Now, I'd be interested to see what happens to that responsiveness and the flashiness when I take out half the memory in the video card. But it had a little panel down at the bottom. Actually, I should call it by its right name. on the E17 desktop, you have panels and, I guess you call them panels and, well, virtual desktops and shelves. A shelf is essentially a panel, like the K panels or the GNOME panels. You can have, I don't know what the limit of panels there are or shelves on the E17, but you can add a bunch of shelves and they can go on any side of the screen, right, left, top, or bottom. And you can control whether or not they have this effect. It's a rotation effect or a scrolling effect that if you go down to the bottom panel where it has a bunch of shortcut icons, and as you move your mouse over it, if you move the mouse to the left, the shelf kind of scrolls to the right. And if you move it to the right, it kind of scrolls to the left. So as you're moving your mouse over it, the icons are moving in the opposite direction, which might seem a little concerning at first and difficult to control, but you get used to it really fast, and it allows you to get to wherever you want to get to a little faster. So it is a neat effect. Sometimes it's annoying that, for instance, like the Firefox icon is over on the far left of this shelf. So as you're scrolling, if you were scrolling to the right of the shelf, you're moving to the right, the whole thing shifting towards the left. If you wanted to go back and click the icon that was on the far left, you would have to actually keep moving over, and sometimes you'll get to the position of the icon before it actually appears on the shelf, so you have to move the mouse back a little bit and keep going to the side to get on top of that icon. Probably not what most people are used to, but not difficult to master or get a grasp on. My daughter Paige primarily used this machine for playing Webkinz, doing a little bit of surfing on the web, playing Fashion Sense, and a couple of the other games. I taught her how to install programs, which at first, you know, I basically said, I want you to go install Frozen Bubble on there, or no, GCompre. And I said, go to it. And she was not able to, like, do that on her own. She had difficulty finding the program to do it until I pointed out to her that, you know, well, it's called Add Remove Programs. So she went into Add, and she found Add Remove Programs, fired it up, was able to navigate that, put in the application she wanted on the search and find exactly what she wanted to install, clicked on that and installed it, and after she got the grasp of how to use it, she was installing programs right and left after that and playing out different games and having a good time. So all in all, it was a little bit of a challenge for her to get her hands on with her experience using KDE and GNOME. It was a bit of an uphill, but she managed to grasp it and continue on and did a good job. The test drive I took it for, I've used it for some basic stuff. Nothing serious. I tried out XChat and installing applications, so I was using it for IRC. I was on the web. I believe it had Flash already installed on it, so I can go to YouTube. It is geared towards using web-based applications, Google Calendar, Google Docs, Gmail. It's got YouTube icon. It uses what is that thing called? Now I can't remember. It doesn't use the browser so much. When you click on something like Wikipedia, it brings up instead not Wikipedia. That's a bad example, but Pat, do you know what I'm talking about? I mentioned it last week, and now I can't remember what it is.
No.
God, what is it? WebRunner. I'm sorry, WebRunner. That's it. It uses WebRunner, which is basically shows you the page in almost like a browser-type window, but it's not actually a full-fledged browser. So it brings up WebRunner. Up in the upper right-hand corner, it has a big Google search bar up there, so it's Google search bar is running a web runner. So if you would type something like Conan in there and click on Google search, it's going to bring up your results in web runner, which again is not a full-fledged web browser, but I guess it just brings up a page, and you can actually go to different sites through it, and but you can't really browse beyond that. It's not a full-fledged version of Firefox. I tried playing some videos through here. Out of the box, it played MPEG-4, which I was surprised. It did a good job. I've tried playing DVDs. It plays non-encrypted DVDs, which primarily are porn DVDs, I guess, in most of the DVD world. It easily played porn, but I could not get it to play a non-encrypted or a regular DVD. I think I put in Windy City Heat. I put in there, and it would not play it. It could not read it because it was encrypted. Now, I'm sure you can install DCCS because the DevRex GPC is running essentially Ubuntu with E17 desktop, so it wouldn't be hard for me to install that encryption software, decryption software on there to DCCS, but I am not, you know, my daughter, I don't think, would be comfortable doing something like that. It would be difficult for her. Overall, I was, I'm enjoying the EverX system. It's very quiet. It's very light. It's not a powerhouse machine, but, you know, it's comparable to a machine maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. It can definitely, I'm sure, benefit from a little more memory in there, and the video card helps out a lot, I am sure. But, you know, if I was going to buy one of these, I might invest the extra $50 and get the higher-end version of this so I have a nicer video card and some more RAM. But other than that, you know, I will report back how it actually works without those enhancements, hopefully by next week when I have more time to play with it. Any questions, gentlemen? And yes, it does have a big-ass analog clock on the right side shelf.
All right.
Well, actually, I should say it's a medium. It's about the size of a quarter. But I need to get my wife to use this and see what she thinks.
So have you guys bought the MacBook Air biscuit yet, Dan, for your wife?
No, she's not getting. She doesn't like. She's not going to get a MacBook. Come on, she's getting a Dell running Ubuntu. We were going to order it last week, but then we held off because we wanted to throw a little more money at it. But then, you know, with that coupon, we can get like a $1,200 system for about $100 more. So, you know, for about $700, $800, you get a $1,200 system. That's going to be nice. So she's going to have
That $400 coupon expires tonight at midnight, I believe.
Yeah, I know, but I'm sure it's going to be back again. I mean,
The $400 one doesn't pop up as much. The last time I saw that, it was right before Christmas.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. I mean, we're not in any rush right now to order it. I know it expired, but I'm thinking that it's going to pop up again or something similar to it. It'll come around again. So maybe we'll wait, maybe we won't.
Stephen Vaughn Nichols wrote that Dell's going to be expanding their Linux offerings starting in a couple weeks. They're going to roll out the XPS 1330 laptop, which is that nice 13.5-inch laptop that's really small, really light and portable.
And it's more expensive, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a higher-end machine. But you know what? It doesn't always have to be a low-end machine. You can get a nice high-end machine, too.
True, true, true.
And it's good news that they're expanding it. You know, they're also offering that laptop model, the XPS 1330. You can also get that with a flash-based hard drive as well. That's a lot more money, though. But you know what, though? It's not as expensive as what Apple has. I think the Apple... If you get the flash-based drive, it's like $1,000 more. And I think if you get the flash drive on the Dell, it's only like it's $750 more. I mean, yeah, it's a lot of money, but it's at least it's $250 cheaper than the freaking Apple.
Well, you know, Alan has one of those now. He has an AirBook.
Well, I was waiting for Alan to announce that he picked up an AirBook and sold his old one to Link for $300. Now, notice how they're quiet.
Yeah, maybe Alan's dead.
Sorry, I had the microphone off there. I was sneezing earlier. I started talking and realized I didn't have it back on again.
Good job,
you know,
there,
I'm quite happy with my MacBook as it is. So,
poor Link's going to miss out now.
So, which one of us is going to end up with the Triple E PC first?
I'm not going to get that. If I'm going to buy something, it's going to be... a pretty beefy laptop. That's what I'd probably pick up first.
So, Alan, you're not going
to
have one?
No, I think I'm going to have to try different
distribution
on my laptop over here. I'm having bad problems with my network right now, so...
On your laptop? Is your card flaking out?
And my wireless, the internal card, for some reason it won't connect. But the really odd part about that is I have a good PCMCIA card that I've been using, you know, on other laptops forever and ever, and I plug that in, and that one won't connect either.
Are you sure it's not your router? Have you tried bouncing it?
Dead Jim.
Well, everything else in my house is running on the router, so... I mean, you know, it's just really odd.
Try bouncing it, because I've had issues like that where my wife was on and using it no problem. I just could not connect for anything. And I kept trying and trying. It would not connect until I bounced the router, and then everything was back to normal. Is it a Linksys?
No, it's a,
generic Korean?
Cheapo. What the hell is it? Belkin.
Yeah, try bouncing the router, see if that makes a difference. I know, like, I have to bounce mine every couple of days because I get weird results. And once I bounce it, it connects, not a problem.
Never had to touch this before.
And, you know, mine ran fine for a long time, and then I just suddenly, it's just like, I got to bounce it every couple of days.
But it's not like I just can't connect to my wireless network. There's a couple other ones in the neighborhood. I can't connect to anybody's.
Maybe it's not your router then.
You know, it's...
If you would have specified that up front, I wouldn't have made that suggestion. Well, wait a minute. Maybe
the weirder part
they need
is,
to bounce
the
their
weirder
router
part
too.
Is this. Like, I'm looking in the K network manager thing, and it shows me what wireless networks are available in the area. I just can't connect to any of them. And that's what I don't understand.
Are you running Ubuntu on there?
Yeah.
Why aren't you running Wicked?
I probably should.
Yeah, you damn well should. Gosh, when are you going to learn?
Link, you can try manually, like, in a terminal. And that way you can see if it's the radio network or if it's the DHCP. Or you can see what's going wrong.
It doesn't give me any more information in the terminal than it does using the K network manager.
D message, it's your
in
friend, baby.
In the terminal,
baby.
All I get is it tells me that DHCP doesn't get an address.
All right. And if you try to do the DH client, like if you sudo DH client, just to force it manually.
I hate having to deal with wireless crap. Does it connect to the access point, though? Like, if you run the IW, what is it? Is it IW config or what are the wireless commands?
How do you spell the Wicked?
WICD.
WICKED.
No, WICD.
WICD.
Is it in
the IW config?
Yeah, IW config. That's
It's IW config and IF config, right?
Now, have you is Wicked in the Ubuntu repositories yet, or do you have to?
No, of course not.
They have a repository.
If you go to the website, they do have an Ubuntu package.
I know they do. I use it. They also have a repository. I'm not sure. I was just wondering if it made it into Ubuntu repositories yet.
There's talk of it, but I don't think it's in there officially yet.
That should replace the freaking network manager, because Wicked.
I agree, man. I totally agree.
Crap. What does Linux Mint use?
Network.
Why not Wicked?
The XFC edition use Wicked.
Okay, so
they're very similar. Like, they have pros and cons, and the network manager is working fine, as far as I'm concerned. And
so
integration with the desktop.
I love Wicked, and Pat loves Wicked, and Dave Yates loves Wicked. And a lot of people I've talked to love Wicked. What is your, in your opinion, what is a con of Wicked? Because I've never heard anything bad, and I'd be very interested to hear a con against Wicked. Like, what the...
I talked to the developers, actually, and so it might get better. Basically, the desktop, the way they develop They don't want to commit to GNOME or a particular desktop, so have an applet in the system tray, and you click it and it opens an application.
So you don't like that? Network,
it's fine, but the network manager lets you do everything from the system tray. You don't actually need to go to...
Okay.
I find that better.
Okay. Understandable.
Because Wikid is actually very good at public.
Yeah, on my piece of garbage laptop that I have here for the last few years, I could never get Network Manager to work, but Wikid works no problem with it.
I think handling encrypted networks, especially the WP addresses, actually keep that.
Yeah, Wikid is a good thing. I like it. You guys have anything else tonight?
Nothing for me.
Are you awake?
I'm awake.
Are you alive?
Who?
You, Dan.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had to
play
walk
us out.
I had to go get the laptop to play this out, so give me a minute. I gotta
okay.
Get back into my desktop.
Sadly, I've got an all-day meeting tomorrow that I've got to stay awake for, so...
good luck.
It's one of those... It's an off-site, all the people, you know, rah-rah-rah type meetings they have once a year.
I blow those off.
I don't get a choice in it. It's a mandatory meeting. And it always tends that we get set... my department always gets... sat at the same table one of the vice presidents is sit at. So. And I'm sure there will be no difference.
Did you go to the last lug meeting by any chance? I couldn't go because
it was
my wife's birthday.
It was just you. It's always just me.
We got to do something. Next week we got to drum up some support. I would have gone, but it was my wife's birthday and I couldn't get out of it.
Yeah, I got a sandwich. I sat up there for a little while. I think I was actually in the middle of a Wegmans party, though, because I sat back where we normally do, and I think they were having, like, some, you know, like their anniversary party was going on or something, because there was, like, a lot of people sitting up there, and they were all, like, Wegmans employees.
Maybe we should go back to the cafe, the place over by me. Everybody seems to like that place.
It makes no difference to me. Just, you know, put it on the website so we all know where to go.
Yep, put it in the calendar. Link gave me access to that so I can update it.
The webpage is also, because the webpage actually says Wegmans in one spot and it says the cafe in the other. A little farther down the page. So we may want to fix that while you're at it then.
Yeah, we have to talk to Link about that.
But yeah, I had my sandwich, sat up there for an hour or so.
By yourself?
No, I was actually enjoying watching people.
Glaring at people.
I had the Nokia with me. I sat up there, was browsing around.
They have Wi-Fi?
At Wegmans, yeah.
That's sweet. You know, Wegmans is like number two on the top 100 places to work. Or was it number three?
They got Wi-Fi. It seems to go just about anywhere. I haven't had it locking me out of any place.
Wegmans is awesome. I miss Wegmans.
Yeah, for people who don't know, Wegmans is a supermarket chain here in the U.S.
It's not just a supermarket chain. It's a super supermarket chain.
Yeah, they try to make it like high-scale, fancy-schmancy kind of deal. They do have a lot of stuff that you don't see in other supermarkets.
Only the best for my dog, Spock.
Yeah, they have like an awesome food court in there with Wi-Fi like we were discussing. So, Dan, did you get that song I put up, or you got something else to play?
Spirit of the Age by Atomic Opera?
Yes.
Yes, I have
yep.
queued up.
Everybody liked them, so we got another tune for them.
Right.
Next week, we're talking to Alana and Orr for a Scale preview, the Scale Prof Conference that's coming up in Los Angeles in a few weeks.
Yes. We have the Scale promo, too. Link, did you get Wikid working?
Nope.
Well, it didn't work or it's not working?
Nothing's working.
Do you have it running?
Well, not anymore.
Lies! reboot into Windows and see if your Windows works.
Can't do that. Don't run Windows anywhere.
Well, is that it for tonight, gentlemen?
I think we're good, man.
That works for me.
It's Clemente. Hey, thank you very much for coming on, spending time with us, and fantastic job. We loved having you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, thank you for staying up, Clem.
And we will hopefully be able to touch base with you again in the future and discuss more Linux mini goodness.
Sure. See you guys. Bye bye.
Take care.
All right, so we're playing out of here with Spirit of the Age by Atomic Opera. Yes?
Yes.
Do they have a website?
Yeah. I don't know.
Where'd you get the song?
On Magnitude.
Okay, Magnitude. All right. Fantastic. Here we go. Atomic Opera, everybody. Oh, wrong button.
By now, you've probably heard about Linux, but whether you're a pro or have barely heard the word, Scale. The Southern California Linux Expo has something for you. Scale 6X will have over 50 speakers covering the hottest topics in open source software and more than 75 booths this year representing a wide range of commercial products and nonprofit organizations. Don't forget Friday's special sessions with Docs, open source software in the healthcare industry, the Women in Open Source Conference, and new this year is the Open Source Software in Education Conference. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2008 at the Westin LAX Hotel in Los Angeles, California. For more information and to register for the expo, visit SoCalLinuxExpo.org. Use promo code CAST, that's C-A-S-T, for 40% off of your registration. We'll see you at Scale.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
It's over.
It's over. It's over, Alan.
It's over. Well, like I said, I got to get to bed. So.
Oh, well, good luck and good night.
Have a good one, everybody.
See you later.
Good night.
We'll talk to y'all later.
Have a good one.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
So long. Oh, I gotta go take my wife to get LASIKs tomorrow. Is everybody gone? Damn. That was cold. It's all left. Anyway. Everybody have a good night.